It's showtime.
Okay, Tokyo, South America, Australia, France, Germany, UK, Africa.
Here we go. Head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! And we are off and running for this live, real-time, not pre-recorded, actually sitting here in the chair, Independence Day broadcast of the Horn. It is indeed the fourth day of July, 2017, Independence Day, 2017, 241 years since the signing of the Declaration of Independence. We'll be taking a look at that document here in a little bit. And unlike the vast majority of this sort of programming out there today, this is happening in real time. So, you know, tell the friends and neighbors. Maybe they've never heard the horn. Maybe they'd enjoy the horn. Great chance to help build the community. But we're here. I'm here. Me and that mouse in my pocket. Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. There is no mouse. And this is the Independence Day edition, 2017, of the Horn. So, just as a general reminder, we'll be having the usual multimedia madcap, zany, wacky, real-time extravaganza in the chat room. If you'd like to be a part of that, feel free to run on over to headonradionetwork.com and click on chat room. And pick yourself out a screen name and a password. And when you jump in there, you will be met by Anatole and Squeaky and Steve from Georgistan and longtime inveterate, indefatigable veteran chat room moderator Sparky, who, being a spacing guild master, has chosen nonetheless not to fold space today and is just happily sitting there being Sparky and not being Man Cave. Welcome to the conversation, Richard. Still probably dealing with some culture shock, having transplanted himself down to Tennessee. Welcome. Glad to see you. More will be along presently, I presume, unless they're outside grilling or doing it somewhat. Who knows? This could also be known as the day, the summer day that dogs hate the most. I saw a post earlier today that said, "I love fireworks," said no dog ever. And my God, it sounded like Baghdad on the New River last night. I can only imagine what it'll be tonight, although maybe not so bad. As I have noted in the recent past, it has been absolutely a beautiful summer here. And we haven't seen rain of any substantial amount in a couple of weeks. But we did today. It's rained off and on all day long. So there we go. I don't know if it's going to... Because here in West Virginia now, we can have small artillery style fireworks. You know, the kind that you go to the show, you know, the big shows to see. Only we can have them in our own backyards now. And apparently a lot of people are excited about that. You know, the ones that have the really deep shake-your-belly kind of thump and thud when they explode. And there's been a lot of exploding going on. Yep, West Virginia has legalized, and I don't know how many other states have, but it's a big deal around here. West Virginia has legalized those sorts of fireworks. Used to be you couldn't buy so much as, you couldn't buy anything more exciting than a sparkler or a smoke bomb. And somehow or another, I don't think we were the less for it. But, you know, hey, capitalism. Because, and well, there's also a tidy little 18% sales tax on it. That's right. 18%. So, you know, a lot of people aren't happy letting letting the coal companies be the only ones getting to set off high explosives around here. A half a million pounds, or, you know, not half a million pounds, millions of pounds of high explosives per day in West Virginia. Still, coal's not dead, y'all. Just a reminder. That's not quite enough. We got to have more. On the other hand, while we can have recreational small caliber artillery fireworks, we can't have recreational, you know, pot, cannabis, weed, dope, smoke, doobie, J, chronic. We can't have that. We can have fireworks going off in the sky. We just can't have them going off in our minds. Although, arguably, the recreational cannabis would probably bring in more revenues to the state by far than recreational small-caliber artillery-style fireworks. And wouldn't scare the dogs nearly as much, either. But, you know, freedom! Sure. So that just a little observation to get things going. A reminder, this is a listener-supported broadcast operation. And a reminder that we will only have a two-hour program on Thursday and Friday. That means on Friday on the front porch will begin almost immediately upon the beginning of the program instead of me filibobstering for an hour. That's because at 9 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, 6 p.m. Pacific, I'll be subbing for Mike and Kathy Malloy, who are off on their holiday vacation. I hope you'll join in and participate. Maybe we'll chat, carry on a conversation, who knows what. And then the other reminder, all this week, and we managed to do it last night. All this week, we're trying to raise double the regular fundraising goal. Because, as I mentioned last night, I need to be in Washington, D.C. next week. Need to be on the road on Monday and in D.C. Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and back here for Friday on the front porch a week from this coming Friday. That, of course, especially this time of year, given what hotel prices are in D.C., will require a wad of cash sufficient to gag a pretty decent-sized horse. Not that I'm into horse gagging. Or anything else gagging, for that matter. But that's where we are. The National Institutes of Health are having a review of the science related to the health impacts of mountaintop removal. And Coal River Mountain Watch, which was central to bringing the issue to the fore is about the only organization that doesn't have enough money to be represented there. And it'll take every bit of $1,000 to do it. Between the rental car and the hotel rooms and Jesus. It's just, oh, Jesus. That's where we are. And look, it's a good thing. Thanks to our monthly subscribers, we've only $50 of which hit this evening. We've only got, and plus the $10 that just rolled in to get us started, courtesy of Glenn. That means we've got $340 to raise this evening. One at $340. Two at 170, four at 85, yeah, eight at 42.50, 16 at 21.25. You know how it goes, but we need to raise $340 this evening. In order to keep even with the idea of raising enough money to so that we won't be in a $1,000 hole by a week from Friday. So, however you prefer, is fine. The PayPal interface is at headonradionetwork.com under the tab Contribute, whereas the for those of you who do not like the PayPal system, and there are several, and there are reasons, you can always use the U.S. Postal Service. The mailing address for that, checks, money orders, that kind of thing, made payable to the Horn, not made payable to Bob Kincaid, is the Horn, 1038 North Eisenhower Drive, PMB 318. Beckley, BECKLEYWV 25801. Okay? So that's, hopefully, we will keep even with all of that. Even if you are not a usual or regular contributor to the Horn, I would suggest this, and especially, I would especially suggest that this would be a good time to do it. Simply because this is a matter of going and standing up for the rights of people long denied basic human rights and human dignity and the simple ability to quietly enjoy their lives as best they can in Central Appalachia. So again, 340 to go in the next 2 hours and 45 or so minutes. Hopefully that will happen. So again, for this Independence Day, I thought we might take a quick look at the Declaration of Independence itself. Of course, there, especially after last night. Thank you, Kay, for keeping it going. Thank you. That takes us down to $315 to go. Thank you very much, Kay. It is deeply appreciated. Especially because of the conversation last night that I had with our buddy Todd, Good Todd, in South Carolina, Stan. Talking about some of the behaviors of Thomas Jefferson. Jefferson, of course, was the principal author of the Declaration of Independence, and it's full of some pretty high-toned words and highfalutin phraseology, almost none of which the signers of the Declaration of Independence were able to actually back up with real conduct. Before we jump into the text at all, it's noteworthy. Let's see. I've got a list here of the signers of the Declaration of Independence. Button Gwinnett supported slavery. Lyman Hall supported slavery. George Walton supported slavery. William Hooper supported slavery. Joseph Hughes, John Penn, Edward Rutledge, Thomas Hayward, Thomas Lynch, Arthur Middleton, all supported slavery. Samuel Chase, William Packa, Thomas Stone, Charles Carroll, George Wythe, Richard Henry Lee, Thomas Jefferson, Benjamin Harrison, Thomas Nelson Jr., Francis Lightfoot Lee, Carter Braxton. Those are all supporters of slavery who signed off on a statement that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Or in the linguistic style of the time, pursuit of happiness. Mm-hmm. They also signed off on the following statement, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive to these ends, of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it, and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness, except anyone who is a slave. See, that needs to also be in there. Any slaves engaging in an uprising to overturn a government destructive of their freedom, well, those people we hang. Because really we don't consider them to be people now, do we? We consider them to be inferior beings. The writings of Thomas Jefferson are absolutely chock-a-block with the idea of how inferior people of color were. But they weren't quite inferior enough for him to stay out of one of them's bed. Because, you know, there's inferior and there's, you know, inferior. And apparently Sally Hemings was anything but inferior when old Marse Tom had a hankering to go a tomcattin around the grounds of his slave plantation. I mean, you know, I wish it was otherwise. I wish our government had been put together by people who had been willing to, you know, like the Republicans and the Libertarians and the Trumpanzees and the Birthers and Deathers and Ninthers and Tenthers and Baggers and Birchers and Booger Eaters all say, and the Ayn Randian anarcho-capitalists. I wish our Declaration of Independence had been put together and approved by men who lifted themselves up by their own bootstraps and by the honest effort of their own industry. But they weren't, and it wasn't. Like I said, there's a lot of high-minded, highfalutin language in the Declaration of Independence, which I might remind people, is not in any wise, not at all, not even a little bit, the law, or any portion thereof, of the United States of America. The Declaration of Independence is, in point of fact, a propaganda document. It is not a petition to the king. It is not nothing. It is a statement of revolutionary intent. It is, for all intents and purposes, a declaration of war. But it is not law. the members of the Continental Congress, among other things, wanted to show themselves every bit as smart and fancy pants as their English betters back across the pond. And so there's language in there about how they've tried to talk to the folks in the Parliament and whatnot. Nor have we been wanting in attentions. And did you know, for all the fun we make of something like an Appalachian accent, the English spoken of the time probably sounded more like what you would hear in the hills and hollers of West Virginia than what you hear on the streets of Baston or Charleston to this day. So, being as how this thing was written by a guy who was raised in the hills of Appalachia, Tom Jefferson, nor have we been wanting in attentions to our British brethren. We have warned them from time to time of attempts by their legislature to extend an unwarrantable jurisdiction over us. They say Jefferson had a high, thin, reedy voice that sometimes could barely even be heard. He never delivered, for instance, a State of the Union address, because back then it didn't mean that it was a speech. It was just a note, just a little note, that the president had to send to Congress on an annual basis. We have appealed in... So you'd probably get Thomas Jefferson something like this.
We have appealed to their native justice and magnanimity, and we have conjured them by the ties of our common kindred to disavow these usurpations, which would inevitably interrupt our connections and correspondence. They, too, have been deaf to the voice of justice and consanguinity. We must, therefore, acquiesce in the necessity which denounces our separation and hold them as we hold the rest of mankind, enemies in war, in peace, friends.
I know, takes a little starch out of the whole Jefferson myth when you hear his voice like that. But that's probably a lot closer to how he sounded than, like, you know, the James Earl Jones voiceover stuff that you get in these patriotic propaganda pieces that air on days like this. We, therefore, the representatives of the United States of America, in General Congress assembled, appealing to the Supreme Judge of the world for the rectitude of our intentions, do in the name and by the authority of the good people of these colonies, solemnly publish and declare that these United Colonies are, and of right ought to be, free and independent states. Luke, I am your father. Never mind.
Which is one of those things that old Marse Tom never said to any of the little youngins playing around Sally Hemings' cabin door, you know.
Grover, I am your father.
Mm-mm. No. Never freed a single slave, Thomas Jefferson. And made sure upon his death that they remained enslaved. Now, George Washington, on the other hand, George Washington freed his slaves upon his death. You know, I'm going to be dead, so I'm not going to have any more use for them, so what the hell? Set them free now that I'm dead. Okay, George. Not Tom. Because, see, Tom Jefferson died bankrupt. Kind of hard to look at that magnificent slave plantation estate on top of that knoll not far from Charlottesville, Virginia, and imagine that the man who built it, who designed it, who ran it, died brokered in the Ten Commandments and poor as Job's turkey, but he did. Because he never could, for all the highfalutin, high-toned language about freedom and liberty, he never could figure out a way to make a dime without having somebody else's back to make it on. Sorry, it's just a fact. 25 minutes past the hour, and I'm Bob Kincaid, little ray of sunshine. Note coming in from Clarence. Three cheers to you. Preach, Brother Bob. You're on point today. Telling the truth is the only way to make America great in the future. And maybe that's the point. Just like democracy, the greatness of America has always been a matter of aspiration over operation. So, people of color don't even get a vague mention in the Declaration of Independence. And there's a whole bunch of men and free, governance are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed men. Women are nowhere in the Declaration of Independence. Sorry, y'all. So there's that. Women don't get short shrift. Women get no shrift. And I don't even know what shrift is. But they don't get any of it. Just like they tended to die, they tended to have a life expectancy anywhere from 20 to 30 to 40 years shorter than that of their male counterparts. This is a good time of year to go and dig up New York Times, I forget where. But there was a brilliant piece written on Benjamin Franklin's sister a few years back. And if you want to see a pretty stark picture of the inequities between men and women, that's a good place to start. There's no reason to think that she was not as intelligent as Benjamin Franklin, nor as industrious, but being born with two X chromosomes instead of an X and a Y, she was born behind the eight ball. And she led one hell of a hard life. And she didn't... it is said that Benjamin Franklin was fathering bastard children, to the extent that bastardy was a thing. Fathering children out of wedlock, shall we say, up into his 80s. And he was absolutely a darling of Parisian salon société. Absolutely adored for his wit by the fashionable of Paris. But not so his sister. If you dig deep into your family histories and go back to this period of time, you will almost certainly find male ancestors who had two, three, four, sometimes five wives. Because women tended to die off through childbirth, disease, deprivation. And men were more likely to be widowers than women widows. So women get no shrift in the Declaration of Independence. Black folks, no, sorry. And of the groups that were largely deprived of their rights, women and black people made up a significant majority. But also, out beyond the Allegheny front, out on the western frontier, there were what are referred to in the Declaration of Independence, the merciless
Indian savages.
Mm-hmm. It's 1776. White people in the colonies have been slaughtering the indigenous peoples of this continent
since about 1620. So 1720, that's 100. It's 146 years.
Just to put that in perspective, what's 146 years ago? 1917, okay, 1900. You know, that's the same as the difference between now and 1879, roughly, I think, ciphering. So there'd been a lot of Indian killing going on since then, which, admittedly, sometimes the indigenous populations did not take any too kindly to. And sometimes, you know, punched back. But the Declaration contains a list of grievances against the King of England, George III. German guy, George. And they included a little gripe about George and the native populations in the Declaration of Independence, which in fact that particular point is an outright lie. This is borne out by history. Don't take my word for it. Go look it up. George III, the crown. Or as was probably more likely to have been pronounced, the crown at the time. The crown had entered into agreements with the so-called five civilized tribes, predominantly the Cherokee, the Muscogee, who were called Creeks, the Choctaws, the Chickasaws, and the Seminoles, that colonial expansion would more or less stop at the Appalachian Mountains and the Allegheny Front. Of course, to make this stick, you need to be able to enforce it, which the king was not very good at because, well, the colonies were left to be sort of self-sufficient and self-defensive because they didn't take real kindly to having those red-coated soldiers marching about because that would have felt a lot like an occupation. And so the colonists, especially out there by the hills, said, fuck the king. And started moving to the American interior, deeper into Georgia, deeper westward into North Carolina and western Virginia, populating areas that would eventually become Kentucky and Tennessee and West Virginia. And in fact, driving all the way to the Ohio River at a place in 1775 called Two Endy Way, where Shawnee peoples, sick to death of having everything that was theirs stolen from them by vermin-infested, disease-bearing, filthy, unbathed, ignorant, illiterate white folks, put up a fight and took a stand and lost. So when the colonists started moving in on indigenous territories, these wealthy white men made up this notion that somehow it was the King of England's fault for the natives not appreciating having their land stolen from them. I can speak to you with some authority on this because one of my ancestors was one of the thieves. Okay? Going back to this time, there was an area of Virginia in Greenbrier County, which later became Greenbrier County, West Virginia, that was called Sinking Springs. And at Sinking Springs, they withstood an attack by aggrieved native peoples because the fort there was among the most westward oriented or westward reaching of all the forts. And so while Jefferson said, you know, the merciless Indian savages he would later on have a little something different to say. Because arising out of those conflicts, and some actually refer to the Battle of Two Endy Way, Point Pleasant, West Virginia, as among the first actual battles of the Revolution. As is so often the case, they're fought by proxies, colonists, land grabbers, versus the indigenous people. So you get Jefferson writing he has excited domestic insurrections among us and has endeavored to bring on the inhabitants of our frontiers, the merciless Indian savages, whose known rule of warfare is an undistinguished destruction of all ages, sexes, and conditions. Now, see, the Declaration of Independence makes reference to God and nature's God. If that God had been real, the moment that Thomas Jefferson was done scrawling that onto parchment with his little carven turkey feather, a lightning bolt would have come out of the sky and just, pssst, and old Marse Tom would have been no more. Because if anyone was engaged at that time in a known rule of warfare that was a an undistinguished destruction of all ages, sexes, and conditions. It was the white folks, colonists. The very first so-called Thanksgiving declared by Governor Winthrop of Massachusetts was in thanksgiving to Almighty God for standing by the white folks while they slaughtered 400 indigenous people. See, this is the trouble with history. If you actually bother to learn it, if you treat it as something more than dry, boring, rote memorization, you will find it to be utterly fascinating. And you might also at the same time look up and go, Jesus, no wonder we've still got the problems we've got. The whole thing was built on lies. Straight up, plain old-fashioned lies. And when it comes to orations about this day, 99% of the pontificating, stentorian politicians and politician wannabe candidates don't know shit for what they're talking about. And of course, that generally applies to the whole of history, not just this particular portion. Undistinguished destruction of all ages, sexes, and conditions. Well, if on July 4th, 1776, the fine, lace-trimmed, high-heeled, powder, makeup-wearing, frock-coat-bearing, wealthy white men, if they had any misgivings about undistinguished destruction of all ages as a known rule of warfare, by God, it didn't stick. Because within 100 years, you'd have people like, Colonel John Chivington. And the Sand Creek Massacre, at which he said of the indigenous women and children, kill them all, nits make lice. Or George Armstrong Custer, who thought that if he could just kind of slip up on Plains Indians and slaughter the living hell out of every man, woman, and child he could get in his sights, that he could go back to Washington and get elected president. That's a hell of a note, isn't it? Using the slaughter of indigenous people as a launching platform for your presidential campaign. Hoo-wee! Yeah. There were some gripes in the Declaration that had some validity. There were complaints about the fact that about the nasty business of transportation. Our friends in Australia know a little bit about this too. Botany Bay and all that. Botany Bay. Captain, it was terrible. They put dings in our ears. Obligatory Star Trek reference. Because the British Empire, having noticed Australia by chance, said, hey, why don't we take that land and kill those indigenous people, too? Mm-hmm. They even went so far as to name a place where they found some goddamn coal in the ground after the same place in the UK where they found some coal in the ground. Newcastle. Yeah, how about that? I mean, this is not to say, and I'm sure there's some lurking right-wing turd.
See, Bob don't love America.
No, I do. I really do. I love it so much, I insist upon knowing the truth about it. So you get that merciless Indian savages bullshit in the Declaration. And yet later, Jefferson would say of Logan, Logan Elrod of the Cayuga people, the son of Shikellamy, who was a diplomat for the Iroquois Confederacy, which gave us the many of the basic notions that would go into the Constitution. And who are now featured in a new museum in Philadelphia, which George Will, right-wing asshole, just because somebody is a Republican who doesn't like it, Trump, does not mean that they're automatically your friend. George Will is still a preening, overbearing asshole. He doesn't like the fact that this museum pays homage to what the United States owes to the Iroquois Confederacy for our form of government. Anyway, Logan is the name that we know the man by. Logan is also who the blood-soaked county in southern West Virginia is named after. And he died in 1780. He died before the revolution was over. And white folks of that time had a real passion for praising indigenous leaders who, having been somewhat enculturated to white ways, managed to say tragically beautiful things, you know, after their people had the living bejesus slaughtered out of them. And so it was that Logan participated. He had been most friendly to the white folks. American history, I mentioned Tishomingo a couple of weeks ago. American history is full of stories of indigenous leaders who were friendly to the whites and wound up paying for their loyalty and their kindness and their decency and their their braveness, their courage with their lives. But on April 30th, 1774, something took place called the Yellow Creek Massacre. A bunch of white folks led by a guy named Daniel Greathouse slaughtered some Mingo people. One of the people they slaughtered was a pregnant woman who was also caring for a little baby daughter. Yeah, what was that in the Declaration about? What's the language Jefferson uses? Yeah. Whose known rule of warfare is an undistinguished destruction of all ages, sexes, and conditions. Well, 2 years before they wrote the Declaration of Independence, white folks were the ones who were engaging in undistinguished destruction of all ages, sexes, and conditions, including a precious little fetus. And so that triggered, as is a natural human impulse, that triggered in Logan an urge for revenge. And Logan had earned the right by the rules established by those civilized people to retaliate against the white people for the murders that took place on Yellow Creek. And they attacked along the frontier. They killed, they took captives. This then led to a response by Lord Dunmore, who was the governor, the royal governor of Virginia. And that then became known as Dunmore's War, of which the Battle of Point Pleasant to Indy Way and became part of American history. Jefferson would go on to write a book called Notes on the State of Virginia. In that book, in 1782, Thomas Jefferson noted favorably the magnificence and power of the oratory. If I'm not mistaken, he may have even likened it to that of Cicero of ancient Rome. After the natives were beaten at the Battle of To Indy Way, they crossed the Ohio River into what we now know as Ohio. And Lord Dunmore pursued them thence, because what we now know as Ohio was part of Virginia then, and in fact Virginia was deemed by title to extend to the Pacific Ocean. And in an effort to keep the war from completely blowing up all out of control, other native leaders tried to pull together a peace delegation. And they asked Logan to participate. And there was an elm tree that stood in that place in Ohio, in Pickaway County, Ohio. And standing under that elm, Logan said no. That tree finally died in 1964. ...200 years old or more. Logan wrote a letter to Captain Cressup. He said, "What did you kill my people on Yellow Creek for? The white people killed my kin at Conestoga a great while ago, and I thought nothing of that. But you killed my kin again on Yellow Creek and took my cousin prisoner. Then I thought I must kill too. And I have been 3 times to war since, but the Indians are not angry. Only myself." But when he refused to attend the negotiations with Lord Dunmore's representatives, when he stood under that elm tree, he said, "I appeal to any white man to say, if ever he entered Logan's cabin hungry, and he gave him not meat." The Christian scholars will pay attention to this, please. You might recognize it. "I appeal to any white man to say, if ever he entered Logan's cabin hungry, and he gave him not meat, if ever he came cold and naked, and he clothed him not. During the course of the last long and bloody war, Logan remained idle in his cabin, an advocate for peace. Such was my love for the whites that my countrymen pointed as they passed and said, 'Logan is a friend of the white men.' I have even thought to live with you, but for the injuries of one man, Colonel Cressup, the last spring, in cold blood and unprovoked, murdered all the relations of Logan, not sparing even my women and children. There runs not a drop of my blood in the veins of any living creature. This has called on me for revenge. I have sought it. I have killed many. I have fully glutted my vengeance. For my country, I rejoice at the beams of peace. But do not harbor a thought that mine is the joy of fear. Logan never felt fear. He will not turn on his heel to save his life. Who is there to mourn for Logan? Not one." And Thomas Jefferson said that that stood with the greatest orations of white Europeans, when at the same time, in 1776, on this day, his words would be published King has endeavored to bring on the inhabitants of our frontiers the merciless Indian savages whose known rule of warfare is an undistinguished destruction of all ages, sexes, and conditions." A little bit ago in his note, Clarence said, "Telling the truth is the only way to make America great in the future." And I agree. Hiding behind platitudes and proverbs and myth only perpetuates the original wickedness. And wicked it was indeed. And for all those who had no rights, who were passed over, ignored, oppressed in the Declaration of Independence, every right that any of the members of those groups have achieved has come at horrible cost. Because at no point in time has the government, which those white wealthy men envisioned, gladly ceded even an iota, a jot and tittle of power. The agony of the slaves is known and documented, and of course, denied by some of the more nasty elements of our country. The torment and torture of women seeking simply to have access to the vote is not as well known as it should be. And by not being well known, is not appreciated. The fact that women have had, even after getting the vote, have had to struggle uphill with one foot in a bucket to get anything even remotely resembling equality, although not even to this day equality, is underknown and underappreciated. And oh, the 500-plus year-long agony of the indigenous people of this hemisphere. From the mouth of a white man, it is almost inexpressible. And so I suggest that the only way to make America great in the future, for we are not great now, and the idea of hanging again, appending again to make America great, well, I think I've just spent the last hour putting the lie to the usefulness of that word. And so I celebrate this Independence Day, as I celebrate every Independence Day, by reading these often hypocritical words, offered up as some statement of nobility of purpose. And thus, it's the 4th of July. But the news doesn't stop on the for a federal holiday. The world does not stop turning, nor the events that happen upon it even slow. And we've got lots to talk about in the coming about hour and 55 minutes. What is believed to have been the successful launch of an intercontinental ballistic missile by North Korea. And given the fact that our government is in the hands of a man who, as we discussed, in the terms of the 25th Amendment, is unable to fulfill the duties of his office by virtue of his various and profound disabilities. Well, it's a little nerve-wracking. To say the very least. And in the aftermath, so much. It is entirely too much to expect of young people to learn a whole bunch of American history in the course of, say, their 11th grade year. That's when I had my high school American history. And if they're still teaching it that way anywhere, then odds are there's a lot of people who stop learning American history at the end of 11th grade. Even a college class taught by a PhD, at the 100 level, freshman American history, if you will. You can't get into this stuff. History is something you have to want to know and have to seek out and find for yourself and care about. History is like a plant. Uncared for, it dies and is known no more. In the aftermath of the American Revolution, this is just one of those things that's kind of humorous. Both sides of the political aisle will claim the American Revolution or its principles for their own. The good, God-fearing, upstanding, Bible-believing, Christ-centered, evangelical, fundamentalist, amosexuals will point to the muzzle-loading muskets of the Revolution and say, see, that's why we got Second Amendment in the Constitution, right after the part about how Jesus is King of America. We got to have right to bear arms in case the Redcoats come back. But in point of fact, there was a significant division in the colonies at this time, 241 years ago, as to whether this whole let's be a country of our own idea was a good one. And after the colonists came out on top, the reprisals, and during the war itself, the reprisals were awful. Things took place in the aftermath of the Revolution that can only be called a purge. And many of those so purged, who were the conservatives of their day, okay? Those were the conservatives. They didn't want to upset the apple cart. They thought if we just talked a little more nicely to the crown and maybe quit shitting on the shoes of Parliament, that maybe they'd treat us like, by God, the Englishmen we damned well were, you know, except for the Scots and the Irish and the Germans and the Jews and the Muslims and the women and the Indians and the black folks. Yeah. Well, they were purged. And they were run right the hell out of the United States. Guess where they went? Oh, Canada, it's fucking cold up here. We shovel snow 3/4 of the year. Yeah, they went to Canada. And lo and behold, who does it turn out that the entire rest of the world thinks are the nicest people on earth? Canadians. Who does the rest of the world think are some of the biggest assholes on Earth? Us. Especially for those of you who are from or live near Philadelphia, it's worth knowing the history of the purges there. Jesus, that was nasty. Mm-hmm. So, just as... I'm not trying to take the hickory smoke out of your barbecue or ruin your fireworks celebration. But which is more important? Actual history or myth? And that's the question we have to answer. I mentioned a little bit ago the longevity of women in that era, and our buddy Reverbo, the human boy, who still does not have his helium-filled pants, damn it. Nor do I. Reverbo noted, that's sure changed in contemporary times. Just count all the husbandless women in old age communities. Too bad for the men now. Well, historically, a lot of that shift comes with the Industrial Revolution. When, because of the needs of capital, male workers were forced into a position of servitude and sacrifice at piss wages. And it thus continues to this day, although we are now seeing, with the end of the 20th century and the beginning of the 21st, some demographic leveling. With more women in the workforce, we are now seeing, especially in a place like Central Appalachia, women used to have an edge on average life expectancy here. In the modern era. Now the life expectancy of women is declining. Because once again, their bodies are beginning to be broken further in the service and to the benefit of America's 0.1% massive wealth aristocracy. So that's our Independence Day filibobster. This is, of course, Independence Day, and it's Conversation Radio. And that means that we should probably engage in some conversation. Don't you think? You know the numbers, I trust, unless you're brand new to the program. The stress line is 304-663-HORN, 304-663-4676. The other line is 304-574-8178. And from anywhere on the planet, you can reach the program via Skype, as long as we are connected contacts. Bob Kincaid Horn, B-O-B-K-I-N-C-A-I-D-H-O-R-N. Note coming from Steve, a member of the Fraternity of Steve. Subject line, Happy Freedom! And here I was, just hoping for a good hot dog smothered in Vidalia onion. I mentioned the 4th of July yesterday to a Chinese friend. She started singing the Canadian National Anthem. Maybe the USA is just kind of a joke these days. Wisdom there, I think. Regards, Steve, in China. Maybe the Canadians are the real Americans. Just a notion. So I have some thanks to extend at 15 minutes past the hour. Thank you very kindly to Jenny. Hey, Bob, happy 4th. I kick in when I can, and I just got paid for the mural I painted, so have a show on me to help you get to D.C. Thank you, Jenny. Thank you so very much. So that means that we were at $315 to go. We're now at $115 to go. And then Charlie jumped in and took us down to $85 to go. After which, our buddy Mark jumped in and took us down to $42.50 to go. And Jack in Shreveport just wiped it out. Thanks, guys. So we have met the fundraising goal for this evening. And that is deeply, deeply inspiring. Thank you. And on behalf of the Appalachian Communities Health Emergency Campaign, thank you. And if I may be so bold, on behalf of those whom we would like to see no longer be poisoned here just for the sin of living here, thank you. And so we'll take our break. This being Tuesday, Independence Day, Brad and Desi took the day off, took the night off, whatever. So no green news report. But, yeah, a break, and then we'll sort of retool, reboot, and come back. And if you want to do conversation, we'll do conversation. If you want more filibobster, you'll get more filibobster. Me, I prefer the conversation. But, again, that's me. This is listener-supported conversation radio. Thanks for all the support. I'm Bob Kincaid.
In America, no tricks at the wheel. No one needs anyone, they don't even just pretend. Jonah's in America.
I'm afraid of Americans. I'm afraid of the world. I can't help it. I'm afraid I can't. I'm afraid of Americans. I'm afraid of the world. I'm afraid I can't help it. I'm afraid I can't. I'm afraid of Americans. A woman, Johnny wants to think of a joke.
I'm afraid of Americans. I'm afraid of the world. I'm afraid I can't help it. I'm afraid I can't. I'm afraid of Americans. I'm afraid of the world. I'm afraid I can't help it. I'm afraid I can't. I'm afraid of Americans.
Jill is in America. Johnny looks up at the stars. Johnny combs his hair and Johnny wants pussy and cars. Jill is in America. The world. I'm afraid I can't help it. I'm afraid I can't. I'm afraid of Americans. I'm afraid of the world. I'm afraid I can't help it. I'm afraid I can't. Yeah, I'm afraid of Americans. I'm afraid of the words. I'm afraid I can't help it. I'm afraid I can't. I'm afraid of Americans.
God is an American. God is an American. God is an American. God is an American.
David Bowie, I'm Afraid of Americans. Hey, I thought that was a pretty good call for a pretty good DJ call for this Independence Day evening, at least here in the Eastern Daylight Time Zone. It's still Independence Day afternoon out in the Pacific Time Zone. And hell, it's Independence Day morning in Hawaii, isn't it? Yeah, I think so. So lo and behold, I got a note from Arnold. He said, yep, Clay Jenkinson's Thomas Jefferson Radio Hour. His voice is exactly as you described, like James Earl Jones or super masculine perfect gentleman. Well, that wasn't how he sounded. And, yeah, it's, look, he really did. He was said to be somewhat introverted. You know, unless he occupied a position of superior power, in which case he could just kind of blow right through the door to the slave quarters and have his way with Sally Hemings or something like that. But he was shy. He was introverted, and he shuffled around the White House. The more things change, the more they remain the same. He shuffled around the White House, built by black people. In a bathrobe and house shoes. Yep. And here we are, 241 years later. And we've got a walking misanthropic monstrosity for a president. Who also shambles around the White House in a bathrobe and house shoes. The only difference being that 241 years later, this guy, unlike Thomas Jefferson,
has the power not to impose his will on a defenseless mixed-race woman on a mountain in Virginia, or make miserable the lives of thousands of people of color and thousands of indigenous people, the madman in the bathrobe now has the power to effectively destroy life, human life, on Earth. Which, incidentally, is the only place that human life, you know, exists. But the world does continue it creeps each day in its petty pace. And so there is plenty of other stuff to talk about. I just, during the break, I mean, I saw mention of it in the chat room earlier. Saw a link to it earlier in the chat room. But I just got to watch it during the break. It's just a brief piece of video of Comrade Kumquat getting off the plane. You can find the video over at crooksandliars.com. And he comes down the stairs, is standing right in front of his own presidential limousine, and just sort of wanders away until a handler comes up and, "No, Mr. President, the car's over here. The big black thing right by the stairs where you just got off the plane. Yeah, that big black thing with the wheels on it. Yes, sir, that's a car. You need to get in the car, sir. No, sir, we're not going to play golf. No, that woman over there doesn't want you to grab. No, she doesn't want you to grab her. Get in the car, sir." Unable to discharge the duties of his office. Say it with me until it just rolls off the tongue. Unable to discharge the duties of the office. Unable to discharge the duties of his office. Because that's where we are. More importantly, that's where he is. As Roger Waters wrote in The Wall, "Surely gone fishing." And the kind of gone fishing that Donald Trump is the kind of gone fishing where you don't need a rod, you don't need a reel, don't need a line, don't need a hook, no sinker, no bobber, no fish, no water. He's just gone fishing in his mind. Or what's left of it. It's a little disturbing because, see, earlier today, or last night, he was tweeting about the North Korean missile launch. Oh, yeah. North Korea has just launched another missile. Does this guy have anything better to do with his life? Hard to believe that South Korea and Japan will put up with this much longer. Perhaps China will put a heavy move on North Korea and end this nonsense once and for all. A heavy move? You mean China's going to grab North Korea by the pussy? That's what Donald Trump thinks about when he says a heavy move. The hell does that even mean? North Korea has just launched another missile. Does this guy have anything better to do with his life?
Then what? Launch missiles? What do you want him to do, Tiny? Play golf? Drive the cart across the greens? Hell, I'll bet you, I will bet you, that even Kim Jong-un knows not to drive the golf cart across the fucking green. You ever try to putt through a... you ever try to read a tire track?
Doesn't he have anything better to do with his life?
Well, I mean, yeah, sure, I guess he could... he's probably been to Moscow. Yeah, I wonder if he had any, pee-pee parties. That seems to be an appropriate thing to do with one's life, if you're the Marmalade Mugabe. You can tell that he was reaching for an insult. But he just couldn't quite reach one. He couldn't quite get there. Up next, Kim Jong-un fat jokes. But he can't do that because then somebody'll skewer him with a fat joke. He's vulnerable on so many fronts. Hard to believe that South Korea and Japan will put up with this much longer. What is he suggesting South Korea and Japan do? When the news was announced about it, because when I run into a spot where I'm historically thin, I try to go and read a little bit so that maybe I'm not completely see-through on it. So I knew, for instance, that from the feudal period of Japanese history forward, the Japanese had kind of had a hard-on for the Korean Peninsula. They'd never been completely successful in conquering it, but they always kind of wanted to. And, of course, there were monstrous atrocities committed against the Korean people during the Second World War. The pleasure women come to mind. Sex slaves. There were massacres and slaughters as well. Koreans were conscripted into the Imperial Japanese Army. And so there is not a lot of love lost between, say, Japan and Korea generally. If Japan were to attack North Korea, there would probably be outrage in South Korea. Because people in both North and South still yearn for a day when there's a unified government on the Korean Peninsula. And so, consider why is there a North Korea in the first place? Well, in the waning days of the Second World War, after the United States had dropped the first atomic device on Hiroshima and pretty much guaranteed the end of the war, Stalin had previously promised that within 3 months of the end of the European war, the Soviet Union would intervene on the side of the Allies against Japan. And so in August 1945, they did. And they did so by occupying Korea. After the end of the Second World War, in the Pacific. Just as was done in Europe, zones of influence were set up, and the American zone was in the south, including the capital, Seoul. And the north was the Soviet zone of influence. Meanwhile, the Chinese Revolution, the Chinese Civil War, between Chiang Kai-shek's nationalists and Mao's communists, raged on. To make a long story short, you wind up with a communist government in the north, supported by the Soviets and the Chinese, and the American-backed government in the south, run by Syngman Rhee, who was not exactly a modern-day Jefferson, or maybe he was. During the Chinese Civil War, several tens of thousands of Koreans fought on the Chinese Communist side and were promised by Mao's government that that would not be forgotten. And so when they were allowed to return home, they were allowed to return home with their weapons. 30,000 or more. This would play a significant role in the beginnings of the Korean conflict. Meanwhile, in the South, the attempts to impose a Western-style democracy there were not going so well. And the Syngman Rhee South Korean military developed a taste for blood and began engaging in periodic massacres and slaughters, which, of course, they then conveniently blamed on the commies. We might have fallen for it, but nobody fell for it there. And that's why, and of course, that when the North Korean government gets set up, it is run by Kim Il-sung. Is he the grandpappy or the great-grandpappy of Kim Jong-un? Be so nice if they just used decent, civilized, Western European naming conventions, wouldn't it? No, it wouldn't. And so, as Ron in the North that doesn't have golf cart tire tracks across the greens, but is apparently somewhat squishy these days, noted, "I'm still looking for a way out of the Korean conundrum, and I don't see one that doesn't involve some sort of conflict. I've got access to at least 1% more intelligence than the average citizen, and I don't run into any optimists." It's kind of hard to be optimistic about. One, you've got a man in the White House who is unable to perform the duties of his office, so that imposes a significant disability on the process. Two, you've got a nuclear nation state that is described as paranoid and pariah. As Douglas MacArthur found out, you've got the entire nation of China just the other side of the Yalu River. This, too, is troublesome. Because, you see, after... in the Korean conflict, the North had pushed the South all the way down to what was known as the Pusan perimeter. Pusan, by the way, is now where things like Hyundais are manufactured and shipped across the ocean. But General Douglas MacArthur, because he was a brilliant tactician, in addition to being, of course, a megalomaniac, conceived a brilliant amphibious landing at Incheon and eventually shoved the Korean forces all the way up to the Chinese frontier. At which point, China, not wanting the aggrieved North Koreans, whose service they did appreciate in their own civil war, but not wanting them really to come visit for a spell, sent about 1.2 million Chinese soldiers across the said river and whipped the shit out of us for a while. Chosin Reservoir, that kind of stuff. And so the armistice was signed, and the no man's land was set up at the 38th parallel. And technically a state of war continues to exist to this day between North and South Korea. Most people don't know that. China, sharing a common border with North Korea, doesn't want to get too ham-fisted with them because you don't even need a missile to get a nuclear device across, detonated in China. And apparently the Chinese think that that regime is maybe just loopy enough to do that. The Japanese, as I noted, are sort of historically unable to do much. Not to mention the fact that their military is constitutionally permitted only to act in self-defense. Although one might argue that lobbing ICBMs into the Sea of Japan might constitute a hostile act. You really don't want the Japanese getting froggy. Because, as noted, that would piss off North and South Korea alike. South Korea has a new president who doesn't particularly yearn for war against the North. South Korea does not have the military structure to contend with the North, which is almost nothing but military. You know, with nuclear devices. So when Ron in the two-puttable North says that he doesn't see a way out without some kind of conflict, I understand. The only thing you can really do at this point in time, it seems to me, unless you're in a hurry to set off some sort of Armageddon chain reaction, you know, we nuke North Korea, or we attack North Korea. North Korea then nukes somebody. China steps in, and pretty soon you're well on the way to there goes the neighborhood. And by neighborhood, I mean planet. And everybody seems to be of a similar opinion that the U.S. is without much in the way of anything resembling good options in this scenario. The only good option being, apparently, not doing anything. Because the very first time that we fire a shot, no matter how righteous we declare our cause to be, fucked. Because there's a significant part of the planet that will see this as an act of naked aggression on the part of the great big United States against the little teeny defenseless North Korea. I had an email from Cranky Todd the other day accusing Malloy and I, of being engaged in a rush to war. Now, I don't know where Cranky Todd got that idea, because I'm about as anti-war as any human being can be. I find very few situations where war is the preferable alternative. And, you know, I'm kind of like Sun Tzu in that regard. Avoid war at all costs, or almost all costs. There's a big difference between aggression and self-defense, for starters. And if we've learned anything from, say, Bush War II in Iraq, and maybe Vietnam and the Gulf of Tonkin, Bush War II, you know, yellow cake, smoking rubble, aluminum tubes, you know, all those lies. Pleading self-defense on something as attenuated as aluminum tubes and Colin Powell pointing at grainy pictures before the UN, very few people are going to buy into your notion of self-defense in that regard, unless they happen to have some sort of commercial reason for selling themselves into it. And don't think for a minute that I don't recognize the drum beating that's going on in the for-profit media. We're not sure, Bill, right now, whether or not the Koreans may have an intercontinental ballistic missile capable of reaching Alaska. We're not certain, Bill, but we think they might be. Back to Fred in the Weather Center.
Really?
When you consider the wealth of targets in the immediate area, the geniuses in the for-profit media are trying to gin up horror and terror and fear that the North Koreans are going to nuke Fairbanks? Having a little hard time buying that one, I am. It sure seems like if I was in Tokyo, I'd be more nervous than if I was in Juneau. I'd be a lot more nervous if I was in Seoul than San Francisco. Ron notes, I've been to Panmunjom with an escort of four Gurkhas. Good times. I was the guy in a black leather flight jacket with the Ray-Bans. Aviators, of course. I suspect there are still a few people in the north looking at all the photos taken and saying, who the hell's this guy? Well, everybody's got to have a hobby, Ron. And hobbies are probably kind of hard to come by up there. Me saying wait and see with regard to North Korea, not do anything. Ron says, isn't that basically the Neville Chamberlain doctrine? No, it isn't. Because what Neville Chamberlain did and has been excoriated by history for doing was actively letting the little guy with the Charlie Chaplin mustache run roughshod over his neighbors. I have not yet seen the North Koreans hollering Lebensraum. Secondly, while people really don't take this into consideration, His Majesty's Army was in no shape to go to war when Chamberlain went to Munich. Had the British Army taken the field against the Wehrmacht at that point in time, there probably would not have been a nucleus of British Army to rebuild around. In 1914, at the outbreak of the Great War, the relatively small British Expeditionary Force under Sir John French, was it? was actually the most well-trained professional military in the world. And at places like Mons, they were horribly outnumbered and still acquitted themselves bravely. That was not the British Army of the late 1930s. And so what actually happened was Neville Chamberlain bought time for the British Army to at least begin to come up to speed. But we just remember Neville Chamberlain for saying peace in our time and being a, you know, sissy, as opposed to that big, tough, butch, racist Winston Churchill. Look, he was good for his time, but Winston Churchill was a racist. He just was. Ron says, you're correct. I should not have made the correlation with Chamberlain. Meanwhile, from Steve in China, charade parade. Still, we're living through interesting times. The pure embodiment of what the French means in the word charade. The charade presidency. There's a kind of historical ring to it, don't you think? Oh, it does. The curse of any system of institutional leadership, be it monarchy or something resembling democracy or republic or oligarchy, is that there is never any guarantee that the person who is the leader will be the equal of his times or her times. If you're lucky, he or she is. But if you bet the odds, he or she isn't. Former occupants of the White House have said that the presidency has a way of humbling you and bringing out the best in you. Well, it certainly has not done that with Donald J. Trump. And it's hard to bring out the best in someone who has no best bring out. Clarence with a note. Subject line, Japan, Korea. Bob, I did 3 tours of duty with the U.S. Air Force in South Korea. I remember talking with the local people about their history. The Japanese treated the Koreans as less than human. The Japanese also killed and enslaved the Koreans. I don't think the South Koreans would blink too much if the North attacked Japan. Probably not. In the imperial period between 1895 and the 1930s, the Japanese actually outlawed the speaking of Korean, the writing of Korean, and tried to impose Japanese as the mother tongue there. History, it's a thing. With the subject line, an echo from the imperial past, our buddy Horst writes from Taiwan, as you know, American Independence Day has already come and gone here. I spent my day like any other, at work. Listening to you just now, I was reminded of Shelley's England in 1819 and thought it in some ways might make a fitting counterpart to our current political moment. Then, as now, the world's mightiest nation was reeling under the rule of a madman, although their checks and balances served them better than ours appear to be doing. Income disparity was out of control, and while not necessarily similar in degree of severity, a number of the same social issues afflicting the English of those years are more than with us now. I have a recurring thought sometimes that the world still seems caught up in the ideological wars of the 19th century. But that's neither here nor there at the moment. Oh, it might be more here and there than you think it is, Horst. Anyhow, the poem, fitting in many ways, not only in the role reversals observed in the juxtaposition of the politics of the world's two most recent empires, but also because just a week ago, Jeremy Corbyn was heard invoking Shelley from a different poem at a gathering, Glastonbury, as his movement appears finally to be gaining some real traction. And thus, from Percy Bysshe Shelley, England in 1819. I will say on Horst's behalf and upon my own that there is a certain loveliness in being an English major. A certain wistfulness and a certain usefulness. England in 1819. An old, mad, blind, despised, and dying king, princes, the dregs of their dull race who flow through public scorn, mud from a muddy spring, rulers who neither see nor feel nor know, but leech-like to their fainting country cling till they drop blind in blood without a blow. A people starved and stabbed in the untilled field, an army which liberticide and prey makes as a two-edged sword to all who wield, golden and sanguine laws which tempt and slay, religion Christless, godless, a book sealed, a senate, time's worst statute unrepealed, are graves, from which a glorious phantom may burst to illumine our tempestuous day. Unless I completely misread that, Shelley was actually being a little bit hopeful there, saying, we are seriously in the shit. But something may yet redeem us. And, of course, laying before him, as he wrote England in 1819, were the colonial glories of the Victorian era, replete with the agonies of the Industrial Revolution. Horst closes saying, Happy Fourth, Bob and Horn Peoples. Have fun. Remember that irony is not your friend. Signed, your pal, Horst. Thank you, Horst. Under the subject line, Little Ray of Sunshine, Matt in San Francisco writes, I know this is going to sound hyperbolic, but I really don't see things turning out well in the near future. There's a nutcase in charge, surrounded by fuckwits who don't seem to understand that words have consequences. They carry on as if they can say and do anything on the foreign policy front, and the other countries of the world will not react. We have not won a war in the last 70-plus years. I've been clean and sober for over 30 years. On a daily basis, these people cause me to question that decision. Mercy sakes, but do I understand that, Matt? You got about 29 years and 6 months on me, and my clean and sober is a different kind of clean and sober. But it's a clean and sober that nonetheless takes a beating. Oh, I could sit here and piss and moan about how, it's the 4th of July and I didn't even get to have a beer and I didn't even get to have any Kaneka sausage on the grill. Yeah, my sister just wrote to tell me that even as I was speaking, she and hubby had Kaneka and the ribs going on the grill. Yeah, bring me over some arugula yogurt there. Lovely. But that's not, you know, no, that's... Well, okay, here's by example. As my father reached the end of his 82 years on Earth, he had, you know, he'd quit smoking a couple of times for, you know, a decade or more. But as he lay dying, he looked at me and said, "Son," I said, "Yeah, Dad." He said, "I want a cigarette about as long as my arm. I'm on the way out. And I'd at least like to enjoy being on the way out." He said, "You know, even a guy before a firing squad gets a cigarette at the end." And he'd been quit for a while. So, I understand. I've been clean and sober for over 30 years. On a daily basis, these people cause me to question that decision. It's getting a little bit stressful. And I have a feeling when I say these things that I'm sort of saying things that other people in the Horn Family Community Congregation are already thinking. In fact, I know they are. It's getting a little aggravating, a little annoying, going to sleep every night and wondering what the... hell, what fresh hell we're going to see in the morning. Made the more so because we know that the guy who's in the White House can't sleep, is operating in a sleep-deprived state, and is sitting around at 3 and 4 and 5 in the morning, twooping. Because that's all he's got. Probably at no other time more than 3 o'clock in the morning, Donald J. Trump knows, to the extent he is able to know anything, because we can't be entirely certain about the pathology of whatever it is that's left of his brain. At 3 o'clock in the morning, Donald Trump knows better than at any time in the day that no one loves him. Think about that. Back in the first hour, we had the question posed by Chief Logan after saying, "Not one drop of blood runs in the veins of any creature on earth." Not one drop of Logan's blood. And then says, "Who would mourn for Logan?" Not one person. That is an existentially painful moment. Donald Trump is surrounded by family. But I dare suggest he knows better than anyone that no one loves him, because he has proven himself over the course of the 70 miserable, misbegotten years that he has occupied air and space and earth on this planet, that he has loved no one and no thing save money. And he probably feels that most acutely, especially because he's in hock up to his orange eyebrows to some people you really don't want to be in hock to. he knows how bereft his life truly is. And therefore, the angry tweets, the lashing out, are what we get in the wee small hours of the morning as a desperate attempt to push back the darkness, the fear, and the aloneness. If you even briefly try to put yourself into that situation, you can pretty quickly come to an understanding of how awful those moments would be, especially if they come not once in a while, but every single night. And even the woman you married doesn't want to share your bed. It is damned hard to get me out of bed at 3 o'clock in the morning, because my beloved Agnes, I, you know, we talk about someone having magnetism. She really does. You have to tear yourself away from the rays that she emanates, that just and pulls you right back in. If he wasn't such an absolutely odious cretin, you could almost for a moment muster a little bit of pity for Donald J. Trump. But not here. Not here. A note coming in from Robert in Australia, subject line about North Korea. From what I've read, Seoul is overlooked by enough conventional weapons embedded in the mountains on the north side of the 38th parallel to flatten that city in no time. Any attack on North Korea would likely result in an attack on Seoul. Such an attack would result in millions of refugees heading south. And yes, the whole situation would run out of control very quickly. Which is probably part and parcel of why Ron in the north wrote the following. Between the First World War and the Second World War, the Brits and the Americans downsized and defunded the military. After the Second World War, America again defunded and downsized the military, decimating the professional ranks. Came back to haunt us in Korea. After Korea, another downsizing and defunding. Then Vietnam happened. The initial years were a disaster. A more professional military emerged in the late 60s, but the Nixon administration, God, I still hate McNamara, even though he's dead, decided to make all the decisions in Washington. After Vietnam, the military was again downsized, the expertise and leadership was lost. Along came Iraq 1 and 2, and the loss of experienced advice was again noted. Notice a trend here? Ron continues, most senior military personnel I know, and have known, are steadfast against the deployment of military force unless absolutely no other option exists. Once deployed, it should be allowed to unfold based upon the advice of experienced military personnel and only up to the point where the antagonist acknowledges that the ground has lost. We don't have that option at the moment due to the completely discombobulated chain of command headed up by the orange toilet clog. Wait a minute. orange toilet clog. I like that. Ron adds, stressful means being shot and they missed. Been there. This is a bit lower on the threshold of stress. Yeah, I get that. But still. Going to sleep every night and wondering what the morning's going to be. And, you know, that's a little bit of American, that's a little bit of American privilege. That's a little bit of developed world privilege. Just being able to be bored by the day to day. Allowing oneself to carouse in a bit of ennui. There's a whole bunch of the world doesn't know anything about ennui. But it's a creepy world we find ourselves in, made the worse upon the realization that we have not a single statesman among any part of the governing majority. There's no one who can exert sufficient influence to keep Donald Trump from being crazier than a sprayed roach. So it's 11 minutes past the hour, and thanks go out. Thank you very kindly to Rusty in northern Colorado. Thank you, Rusty. Rusty kicked in and took us all the way to a full $400 raised this evening. Rusty says, thanks for being here tonight, Bob. Thank you, Rusty, for being here. Otherwise, I'm just kind of yelling into the void. And there's, you know, not a lot of fun in that. So we'll take a little break and come back. Look, lines are open. The stress line's open. Somebody's on 8178. But 304-663-HORN, 304-663-4676 is wide open. And by the way, in the future, once we get a little bit more of this madness out of the way, I'm going to add another phone box so that we will have yet another phone line. So that's out there. That unit is $400. We'll attend to it when there are less, well, when the fires are banked. Once again, this is listener-supported conversation radio, and thanks for all the listener support this evening. Thank you so much. Be right back. I'm Bob Kincaid.
In the wee small hours of the morning, while the whole wide world is fast asleep, you lie awake and think about the girl and never ever think of counting sheep. When your lonely heart has learned its lesson, you'd be hers if only she would call. In the wee small hours of the morning, that's the time you miss her most of lesson.
you'd be hers if only she would call. In the wee small hours of the morning, that's the time you miss her most of all.
Yeah, okay, so I'm an old softy. I just love that song. Do you realize that Frank Sinatra's Wee Small Hours of the Morning album is often noted to be the first concept album within the genre? It's true. Yep. He was all busted up and heartbroken after things fell apart with Ava Gardner. And he used to refer to that as the Ava song. It was Ava Gardner, right? Let's run over and check in with the aforementioned Ron in the far and yet not frozen north.
Yea, verily, Bob.
How's the Rev?
Oh, the Rev's just fine, thank you. Without the Rev's assistance and guidance, I would not have the chutzpah to dare to call in.
Chutzpah?
Wrong. I lie.
Of course.
Yeah.
Just not much.
Not much, no.
About 1%.
Saw a pair of socks in the store the other day, upscale department store, and they were $24 for this pair of socks, but they had a monogram on that almost made me want to buy them.
Really?
It said, I don't lie. I just make this shit up. And I thought...
Okay, was the presidential seal on the other side?
Unfortunately, no. But that was an aphorism that I looked at and went, oh, hell yeah. I can see that. So I took a picture of it and posted it. But
you didn't drop the 24 bucks Canadian on it?
No, my mama didn't raise no fools. No. But anyway... I was just thinking earlier that I'm wondering if there's ever been a parallel besides King George III of having a leader of a major nation in the world headed up by somebody like the Toilet Club. Can you name one?
Are you kidding me? I mean, does it have to be the modern world?
Yeah, it should be World War II and beyond.
George III. I mean, you kind of opened the door to at least the 18th century. If you're going to talk
well,
George III.
Yeah. Oh yeah, details. Yes, I have. Of a major nation.
Well, there's crazy, and then there's detached. And sometimes detached can be every bit as dangerous as knuck and futz.
Oh, yeah.
And a detached ruler, leader, whatever, can be every bit as dangerous. I think of the last French king. Of course, the French royal house was rather notorious for having... an unfair share of, you know, outright venal or, you know, mentally deficient. And then there's the Spanish royal house. Charles, who was so thoroughly inbred that he was almost incapable of human behavior. But, you know, they dressed him up and trotted him around.
There are moments when I regret regressing back to George III. as a baseline. You're right. In the modern era, anybody quite as deranged as the current dipstick in the
Okay, we're still working pre-World War II. How about the vicious evil of
Moose.
No cheating. How about the vicious evil of Leopold of Belgium?
The third of Belgium, yes. He was the third, wasn't he?
It seems right, but I can't recall. Yeah. But, you know, had it not been for the rise of Stalin and Hitler, we would remember Leopold and, generally speaking, the Turks as the parents of modern genocide.
Yeah.
And Leopold, in many ways, Leopold is deprived of the opprobrium that he so richly deserves.
Yeah. I have a brother-in-law who's Armenian, who escaped from Armenia, was raised in Egypt, got his PhD in organic chemistry from University of British Columbia, and to this day lives to wreak shit and havoc upon the Turks. So we're talking about something that goes back three or four generations. And we're a very tribal species, you know?
Well, we are. Look, we are hyper-evolved primates. I mean, we just are. There's no running away from it. But I'm still working on post-World War.
Okay.
Post-Second World War. How about Pinochet?
He was a dictator. Yeah. One country. Didn't have a major impact anywhere outside of Argentina. So.
Chile.
Sorry. God damn it. Got my wine countries mixed up. I'm drinking a Chilean wine tonight, so I will.
Well, I'll bet you.
Some of them are decent.
Get in the game. No, Chilean wines, not bad at all. Said the guy. Well, said the guy. You know, riding along in his little square wheeled wagon.
I gotta say, I really enjoy the windows where I get an opportunity to call in. They're not that many, but it's usually an intelligent conversation. And if it's not intelligent, it's usually my fault.
Well, if it's not intelligent, it's usually madcap, which is extra double plus good sometimes.
Yeah.
A little nonviolent bedlam from time to time can be. Yeah, it can have a curative effect.
I enjoyed your reference to the loyalists earlier in the show, who came to Canada, settled in southern Quebec and Ontario,
and also to the east. Shitload of them went to New Brunswick.
Yeah, and then a bunch of the French Canadians got pushed out and went to Louisiana?
Yes.
They were called the Acadians, I guess.
Right.
Yeah. I wouldn't want to make a connection between the two, but it's been a benefit to, certainly to Louisiana, to have some moderating influences on their culture. But,
well, somebody had to bring the accordion to the lower Mississippi Delta.
Yeah. The last time we were in New Orleans, there was an Acadian group on the street in New Orleans that played some of the absolute best bayou music I've heard in years. All live. They were phenomenal. And I was going up to give a donation after their street concert, and they'd made $5 by my reckoning. For 20 minutes of just wow. And I threw a $50 bill in their hat, which I couldn't afford, but...
But it was New Orleans. You'd had a couple. The music was good. The weather.
No, I'd had nothing. But my thinking was, even though I can't afford this, for Christ's sakes, it was that good. And I'll figure some way out to break even later. And it was, the guy tipped his hat and went, had to have been there. And the guy said, you from Canada? And I said, yeah.
Yeah, how'd you know?
He went, yeah, how'd you know? Yeah. And apparently Canadians going through New Orleans are a segment of contributors to people keeping music as it should be in New Orleans. And
well, the whole francophone subset of the population of Louisiana, you know, the so-called Cajun culture.
They ain't francophone, they're Acadian.
Well, see, there you go. And it was.
They'll get right up in your face about that.
Well, but it was all too, as is all, you know, it's all about the homogenization, and very nearly completely killed out that culture.
Oh yeah.
It is something approaching miraculous that it still exists, and what a net boon. I mean, I'll go to YouTube every now and then and just watch an old Justin Wilson cooking show.
Oh yeah.
Just to sit there and listen to him talk.
Listen to the accent. Yeah.
And it's not just the accent; it's the word usage.
And the spices. Yeah. The guy could cook.
Oh yes, he could. And it just the syntax and the grammar. Oh, it's yummy. It's yummy. It's as good as the food itself.
In any event, I wanted to briefly mention my approbation about North Korea to introduce a solemn note to the discussions. How does one crazy sumbitch deal with another crazy sumbitch?
Oh, that's kind of how it shakes out, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
I mean, to make Star Trek reference number two, obligatory Star Trek reference number two tonight, there's some serious Kobayashi Maru about North Korea. It's hard to envision a situation in which anybody wins.
Yeah. And your previous caller... not caller, but commentator who mentioned that Seoul is within artillery range of North Korea. There's 4,000 long range weapons trained on Seoul from across the border. And you can bet they have every neighborhood, every district targeted in. Everybody's got their coordinates. It will be absolute mass destruction of 20 million people.
Forget the nuclear side. I mean, there will be a refugee crisis, but there will be a whole lot of just dead people.
Yeah, there'll be 9 or 10 refugees. They've got that area mapped, and they've had 20 years to do it or more. And that doesn't require nuclear. That's just conventional artillery.
Yeah, nobody has to light the big party favor.
Oh no. And you're sitting there and you go, okay, first of all, why would anybody continue to live in Seoul? And I can tell you we've got a lot of folks who work in diplomatic communities who live 30 miles south of Seoul and drive into work every day through the traffic.
They're not out of range, yeah, though, are they?
For conventional artillery, yeah.
Oh, 30 miles south is out of range.
Yeah.
But that's out of range for a day or less, you know, after the,
no,
you know, because first comes the artillery barrage, then comes the infantry.
And then comes the counteroffensive, which would turn every bit of the top 20 miles of North Korea into a vegetable patch. They ain't getting through there. Nothing's getting through there. They've had 50 years to plan this. So,
and how long? Not questioning your authority, Ron.
I got no authority.
How long? How long did the French have to perfect the Maginot Line?
Yeah. All I'll say, there is enough material implements in place to make sure that there's nothing big and major coming through that border within 20 miles that's going to have an impact on anybody below it. And that's before all the latest deployments. And there's a bunch of stuff that I'm sure we won't ever hear about. But no, North Korea is not invading any place past Seoul in Korea, period. No, ain't going to happen. So that being said, you got to wonder, what the hell do you do if you're the North Korean government and your capital's in Seoul and you know shit happens, I'm going to get wiped out. Why don't they move the capital south?
Say, Busan?
Yeah, that would work. Yeah. Keep the seat of government intact.
Well, don't you reckon there's an evacuation plan along those lines?
So what's your basic evacuation plan that could be implemented in 5 minutes?
Yeah, there's that.
Yeah.
But you ask, you know, why would you live like that? There's a much older example and longer lasting. And it happens all over the planet. And frankly, there is, relatively speaking, greater danger from it than from a chubby little asshole in Pyongyang, or a chubby big asshole in Washington D.C. Consider Naples.
Yeah.
Do you know what the projected numbers are the next time Vesuvius lets off one on a scale of what happened at Pompeii? And the fact that it's unlikely that Vesuvius will never let off another one. I mean, talk about nowhere to run. You know, you don't have a whole peninsula behind you. You've got a bay.
Yeah. How deep can you dive? And how long can you hold your breath?
History suggests, based on the writings of Pliny the Younger, not long enough.
Yeah, but Italians have always been optimists. Koreans, not so much. So, in any event, I just wanted to opine that I don't have a single thing to add to the equation in terms of solutions, but I don't see a real good, you know, end of Green Gables out. Come from all of this.
Oh, that was so Canadian of you.
You noticed. Yeah. Oh, thank you. Thank you very much, sir.
Hey, and you know, and don't completely pull the starch out of my volcano analogy, please. I wasn't done.
Well, I'm sorry, sir. Please continue.
Consider the either most or second most populous city on Earth.
Atlantis?
No. Mexico City. And yeah. The Greater Valley of Mexico.
Small capital of the world.
Well,
yes, sir.
There's that, and there's the fact of Popocatapetl and 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 Iztaccíhuatl. I don't know if you pronounce the name. Iztaccíhuatl. I keep getting notes saying, Bob, we're going to have to work on your Nahuatl pronunciation, but, you know, I may be too late for that. But those are two
just call them Biggins?
Those are two very big, very active, potentially
lethal,
hell-raising kind of earth yawning open kind of volcanoes. And people have still, whether it both pre-Columbian and post, not seen fit to decamp there and go find some place that isn't in the shadow of a volcano.
Yeah.
Arguably, Constantine knew in the 4th century when he was laying out his new city that little spit of land sticking out into the Bosporus was prone to earthquakes. And lo and behold, we've had it. Didn't we have an Istanbul earthquake in the last 12 months?
Yeah, we did. Yeah.
Nobody leaves.
Hey, if we had earthquakes in West Virginia, how many people would leave, Bob?
None. I don't see a mass exodus. Why? I don't see a mass exodus out of California, do you?
No, never have.
Because it's home.
They predicted it for West Virginia.
Because it's home.
There you go. Yeah.
Human beings.
That is so.
Human beings are migratory when they have to be. But we like to be sedentary. That's why we. That's why we got tired of being hunter-gatherers and wandering all over the planet and just settled down and started, growing barley in Mesopotamia.
Ooh, barley. Whiskey. Ooh.
Beer.
Good for them. Ooh. Now that's a boon to civilization.
One of the first things that literate humanity ever did was write down the recipe for beer. Hey, guys, we don't want to forget this.
Hey, other than that, water is just for living.
As W.C. Fields said, yeah. Fish fucking that.
Yeah. Yeah. And bread is beer that's gone to a poor afterlife.
Bread is dried out beer.
We digress.
I don't think so. Okay. I don't think it's a digression. We are examining the human condition, Ron.
We're on one of our conventional tracks. I'm going to observe that I intend to revisit my old haunts in Appalachians the last 2 weeks of August. And I hope to strap your ass into a golf cart and drag you around smoking illegal cigars at some point in the last 2 weeks of July.
Well, I look forward to accompanying you. I'm a damn fine golf cart driver. I can also...
Drive.
I can.
Sure.
Yes.
Driver?
Absolutely. Driver. Well, or three iron. Who knows? Perhaps a mashy niblick.
Okay. Anyway, I'm coming back to the home country, and I'll check in when I get there, and we'll work out a schedule.
Absolutely. Do please, because even if I can't hoist a tankard with you, some of the most, and she still says this, some of the most enjoyable tankard hoisting Agnes has ever engaged in has been in your company.
Whoa.
Did you say August? I think it's July.
Well, one doesn't really know how to respond to that without antagonizing the host, but yeah, I enjoyed it too.
Oh, I'm not a jealous guy in that regard.
Okay, just to be clear, last 2 weeks of July.
No, you said August.
I know, July.
Is it July now?
July. It's July.
Okay.
That's two full weeks. Okay. And I will call ahead to apologize for you and the fact that you can't carry clubs or whatever. And then we'll go on our merry way.
Absolutely. Tell them you are, let's see, I am a caddy without portfolio.
Yeah. I've gone through a long list already, and I ruled out psychotic and a few other labels. I'm going to go, this is my buddy.
In West Virginia, well, that'll probably work.
It'll work, yeah. It will. Anyway, I'll touch base sometime before I arrive, and we'll take it from there.
All right, sounds good, Ron. We'll talk soon. I've enjoyed it.
Bye, y'all.
Later. The one, the only, the erudite, the capably digressive, Ron in the Two Puttable North. Notes arriving from Steve in China. Police farce. So much depends on knowing what you were about. The military has two precise functions. One, destroying things. Two, killing people. I think we were much more clear on this fact a generation or so ago. I had conversations recently with a veteran of the current round of American military interventions, a fellow English teacher. He served as a kind of linguistics and communications expert with the Army, going around to people's houses asking questions, trying to establish trust among the community. His frustration and perplexity with the whole affair was evident without further commentary. Wrong job, wrong place, wrong army, no dice. You just can't show up knocking on the door, gun in hand, pretending to be a Boy Scout, when the stink of death is all around. So true. And we came up with that hearts and minds notion in Vietnam, and we have yet to figure out that it's hard to win hearts and minds when your neighbor is running down the road naked on fire from, you know, napalm. And we didn't get any better at it in Bush War II. As I have noted in the past, there is nothing quite like a grandfather dragging the broken, battered, blasted, bled-out body of his 4-year-old granddaughter out of the rubble of his home and tenderly carrying her lifeless body in his arms to somewhere where people can clean her up and able to give what's left of her a decent burial, to sort of make you not ever want to do anything but, you know, kill Americans. Eh? God knows it's been sufficient casus belli since the 7th century for various practitioners of various sects of the dominant faith tradition there. The Sunnis don't call the Shia Shia, they call them the Ismailis, I think, because it all goes back to an argument over who was going to be the true heir of Muhammad. You know, 6th, 7th century. 14 centuries ago. Still worked up about it. But, of course, the West doesn't get a pass. You'll note that the great schism between Orthodox Christianity and Roman Catholicism isn't likely to be solved anytime soon. Even though the Roman Catholic priests look over at the Orthodox priests and go, huh, get married, huh? Son of a bitch. Thought God said you couldn't do that. Nope, that was Pope. Damn it. And, you know, you've got Jains who go crazy in India and slaughter Hindus. And then there's the whole thing that happened with Indian independence between the Muslims and the Hindus. And, oh, for all have sinned and come short of the glory of God, right? And by the way, Steve points out, when I said Pusan, maybe? Pusan, tiny little town, U.S. Navy port of call, spitting distance from Japan. Oh, okay. Thanks for the clarification. Asa tells me the Ismailis are a separate sect, more liberal, different than the Shia. Ah, they're probably equally worthy of being slaughtered by the Sunnis, though, aren't they? Oh, it must be coming on toward dark. It's beginning to sound like Hillbilly Baghdad out there again. There are dogs running under the furniture all over the place. Ooh-wee. But we got us some fireworks freedom here in almost level west, by God, Trump genius stand. How? That's one thing the Republican legislature, they ran right out and did that. Couldn't pass a budget! But they made sure we had some fireworks. You know, it's a little unnerving when one of those big-ass shells goes off and then you hear clackety-clackety-clatter-clatter-clatter-clatter-clatter as the residue from same rains down upon your metal roof. We experienced that a few nights ago. It was something less than soothing. To Agnes. Of course, I had to let on out like I wasn't bothered. But, you know, me being me, I was thinking, I know what that sound is. That was the sound, going back to my conversation with Ron, that was the sound they heard in Pompeii and Herculaneum as the first tiny little pieces of pumice ash cooling on their way back down through the atmosphere began to skitter across the clay-tiled rooftops of Pompeii and Herculaneum. And then it got real ugly. So tell me, we're running out of time, but tell me if you've got another alternative to just sitting still and watching and waiting to North Korea. I got a breaking news alert from the New York Times. You know, I'm on their mailing list. They reach out to me. The new phone book's here. But the New York Times just announced that the Trump regime has confirmed the North Korean claim that it had launched an ICBM. ICBM is not the same as that frozen blue stuff that breaks off of aircraft in the high altitudes, frozen, and lands on Earth. The effluvium from the toiletries. No, that's an ICBM. That's a very weak cowbell for that. No, they confirmed the ICBM launch. And said that in response, the United States military and South Korea conducted joint missile exercises. Mm-hmm. In which they fired missiles into the waters along the east coast of the Korean Peninsula. Well, wasn't that butch?
Really? Okay, you launched an ICBM? All right, we'll show you. We'll shoot a few million dollars into the ocean. Ha! Take that, you little pissant. Yeah. The Trump Pentagon said that it communicated to the government in Pyongyang that the United States would use, and this is a quote, the full range of capabilities at our disposal against the growing threat. And this, of course, is after Kim Jong-un had tweaked the little bulbous nose of Donald J. Trump by saying it was that the ICBM launch was a 4th of July gift to the Trump regime. Oh, this is going to end so well. According to the North Korean news agency, he said, we should send them gifts once in a while to help break their boredom. Jesus, is this guy sitting on a big chair stroking a bald cat? It is very cold in space, James Bond. God damn. Do you think the North Koreans didn't know we had missiles we could shoot into the ocean? Just, you know, asking. Ah, it's symbolic. That's what it is, Bob. It's symbolic. Hey, look. There's Jim. Hey, Jim.
Happy 4th, sir.
Happy Independence Day.
Well, whatever. People are celebrating right and left in D.C. Bob, I used to go up there two or three times, but after the fourth time, I said, I'll watch it on TV. After getting out of the Smithsonian exit and trying to get in that crowd and then going home, that was just a real horror show.
Oh, I can imagine. Does it sound like Baghdad and Beckley?
Not really, but I mean, they did have some magnificent fireworks and stuff like that from the Potomac, from those barges they float out there. They're really quite spectacular.
And who can forget that stirring concert by the Beach Boys endorsed by Nancy Reagan?
Oh, they had one of them on there tonight. You know, Nancy loves her Beach Boys, and I guess I don't know what to say about them. Where's Brian Wilson now?
I really couldn't tell you.
I know, but I just used to have some guy pretending like that he was Brian Wilson, but the guy was just really, really retarded. I think something bad happened to Brian Wilson, you know?
But, acid? Just too much, maybe?
I don't know. He just is not very functional, from what I understand. That's the thing that I must try to portray. But, you know, going back to this business of missile launches and things of that nature, it's just a contrapuntal fugue, subject and answer. But it's not by J.S. Bach. And you're going to have one answering the other. And it will get louder and louder and louder if it continues. I don't see anything good about that situation over there. I do not.
No, nor do I. I mean, but, and the thing is, it's a different dynamic than, say, the Cold War stalemate between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. It is an entirely different dynamic.
No, absolutely. I mean, with the USSR, and the USA, they sort of had an understanding about certain situations. And the Soviet strategic rocket forces were not as dangerous to the world, and our forces were not as dangerous to the world back then as now. Those nukes are in possession of other countries and other types of ideologies. You know, believe it or not, it was a Soviet lieutenant colonel who actually saved the world. Well, he saw a blip on his radar screen.
It was
not a missile. But he did not call the Kremlin. He waited his time and realized that it was something else. And if he had called the Kremlin with that, the way things were back then, it would have been goodbye, everybody. That's for sure.
And yet, you know, that's a dodged bullet. But the thing is, like I said, the dynamic is so different, Jim. I don't know if that conventional wisdom has anything that's even remotely helpful in the present
dynamic.
Well,
you know, we approach it, and the Soviet Union, for example, realized that this war was totally unwinnable, and the only way to play the game was not to play. But there are other people who have other ideas, and they think that there is a survivable nuclear holocaust.
Do you think North Korea falls into that camp?
Mm-hmm. That man is as crazy as a sprayed brooch. That Kim Jong-un, he is just absolutely nuts. So he didn't realize what the hell he's doing. Because in the first volley of that particular war, he and his capital would cease to exist. Pyongyang would be nothing but a hole in the ground.
But it's near.
We have plans for him.
But it's near enough China, Jim, that making that hole in the ground might be sufficient to irradiate some real estate we really didn't want to.
Well, that's true. And you have to have sort of prearranged negotiations with China, and I'm sure we have. If this should happen, then we cannot destroy the rest of it. I mean, under Mao, yeah, they could under Mao. I mean, they asked Mao one time if he lost, out of 1 million men, 300,000. He said, well, I still got 700 million left. He didn't care. But I think things, the dynamic has changed in Beijing a little bit. I don't know. They're now living the life that's much better than what they endured under the great leap forward back in the 50s and, you know, the long march of 1934. I think they've become a little better, even more better than the Cultural Revolution of 66. I hope so. I'm being optimistic.
I know. And as had been noted, Mark just wrote in and said, North Korea can fire over 500,000 artillery rounds into Seoul within 1 hour, firing from 15,000 various hardened bunkers. Nerve gas VX would obviously escalate the situation. Proceed with caution. Semper Fidelis, Independence Day.
Yeah, they have 10 million men on the border right now who could easily go over that 38th parallel, that's for sure. 10 million, that's a lot of people. And there's only a way to stop 10 million men. And you know what it is, and I know what it is.
But the other side of it, Jim, is that when one is sitting in a rowboat on a lake of gasoline, one is well advised to sit very still and try not to even think about anything that could cause a spark.
Well, that's true, but have you ever seen that sort of thing happen and people think like that, Bob? No, I've read a lot of history, and I haven't seen a whole lot of that type of thinking. They've gone ahead and lit that spark.
On the other hand, though, to what extent, I realize you've said that Kim Jong-un is just crazy, but to what extent is he making it, very, very difficult for anybody to get bellicose with him? If they don't actually attack somebody, if they just periodically lob something into the sea, it reminds me of the quills of a porcupine. Porcupine doesn't look like much until it deploys those quills.
No, you don't want to mess with one of those, that's for sure. They could really put a hurting on you. But, you know, I think the solution to Kim Jong-un and Pyongyang comes through Beijing. If they were to cut them off and completely destroy his regime, because, I mean, if you go over South Korea, it's completely lit up. North Korea, it's dark. The people there lived like peasants in the Middle Ages. And the only center of activity in that particular regime is in Pyongyang, and maybe a few other satellite cities in which you'll find Kim Jong-un ensconced. And I don't think it would take much to take him out. I really don't.
I don't know that just taking him out would be sufficient. I think you have to take out the oligarchic or autocratic center, and
how many of them are there?
I don't know, but I mean, there's a line of succession. So Un's, you know, it's kind of, you remember during the Iraq War when every other day we killed Al Qaeda number two?
Oh yeah.
And the next day there was another Al Qaeda number two.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the only problem with that line of reasoning. I hate to say it, but I'm actually over time, so I got to get out of here, Jim. But happy Independence Day to you, and I hope.
And to you.
I hope your furry friend is not put off by all the explosives.
Mm-mm. As a matter of fact, he is thoroughly ensconced, but he's by breakfast tray.
Very good, very good.
He likes to get underneath there. He feels secure.
There's
somebody to let them off right now.
He's unflappable then. Very good. Jim, have a good evening.
And the same to you, sir.
Bye now. Our buddy Jim calling from not too far from here. Time to get out of here. Thanks, everybody, for making it 2 days in a row of meeting the fundraising goal so I can be away from here next week. Thank you very much indeed. We'll try again tomorrow, prayer meeting Wednesday. Thanks to all of you who contribute. Thanks to all of you who listen in whatever and participate in whatever way you do. Thank you to our all-volunteer staff. Thank you to the hardest-working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net, and Coal River Mountain Watch on Facebook. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you. Good night, y'all.